From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The perpetrator in Sunday's shooting in Gilroy, California at the annual Garlic Festival has been identified as 19-year-old Santino William Legan. The shooting spree that killed two children and one adult was conducted with an assault-style rifle. Police shot and killed the shooter. News media reported that shortly before the shooting, Legan posted a caption on Instagram saying, "Read Might is Right by Ragnar Redbeard." According to CNN, Right is Might, first published in the late 1800s, has been described as a white supremacist text that promotes anarchy while vilifying Christianity. Meanwhile, President Trump has decided that rather than study why young white men with white supremacist views are a danger to society, it's more important to focus on Antifa, the banner under which anti-fascist activists organize. My guest is Melissa Figueroa. She's a PhD candidate in geography at UC Berkeley. She's also a faculty owner at the Cooperative New School for Urban Studies and Environmental Justice. She's been a longtime political educator and organizer involved in a wide range of movements for social and environmental justice in California. And she's also a regular correspondent for our show. Welcome back, Melissa.
Thank you, Sonali.
So you are a resident of Northern California. You are a lifelong Californian, Gilroy, Texas, for anyone who's driven up the five toward California, can smell it before they see it. Gilroy is the garlic capital of California, at least, if not the nation. How terrifying was this shooting in this quite small community?
It was shocking. Given the rash of, shootings that happen with such frequency nowadays, being shocking in that context is especially shocking. Something like the Gilroy Garlic Festival is a family-friendly event. It is like, it's like ice cream and kittens. It's benign. It's like, it's a place where, that people associate with like happiness and food and like, enjoying, it's a ritual, it's a summer ritual for a lot of people. Right. And so, to see this kind of invade that these spaces, is both, saddening and also, an indicator of this kind of slow protracted decline that we're seeing in American society.
Of course, gun violence is so endemic to the United States that one, two, three people killed here or there is almost normalized. But what is quite significant in this particular shooting are the likely motives of the shooter. I mentioned the Instagram post that he made, and as news media are sort of trying to attempt to piece together a motive for a 19-year-old, a teenager to do this. It does seem to be that he espoused views that a lot of shooters, young white male shooters espouse, that he might have very well been a white supremacist. What do you know about what the media has said so far about him?
Well, in this case, it's interesting to see a little bit of difference in how the media has been have been portraying the shooters. We get so used to this narrative of like the lone wolf or like the troubled teenager who goes crazy and mental illness. We have all these different kinds of narratives that are deployed that kind of isolate the perpetrator in a kind of box. And so this pattern of seemingly random events, becomes a little bit, it stretches the imagination to think that, this is just kind of like this isolated popping up of things that are going on. The fact that the media has indeed kind of foregrounded the white supremacist views and of this shooter, I think is a little bit of a change in the coverage that we're seeing, and kind of a welcome one. It doesn't stretch the imagination to think about how several of the last major mass shootings have been tied to white supremacist, anti-Semitic, or otherwise, fascist or fascist adjacent beliefs.
Right.
This is especially troubling, as I was kind of investigating, right, the right-wing message boards and stuff several years ago. I've seen, many times sort of mentions of the use of sort of mass shootings or seemingly random events of violence as a kind of a way of sowing chaos in society. I'm not trying to say that there's like a conspiracy or anything like that, but it has been well documented that, say, after some of these mass shootings, like the Parkland massacre and the Dylann Roof shooting, that a lot of these these communities of hate groups will celebrate the shooters. And it's not a it's not altogether insane to understand how this pattern of like celebrating mass shooters, of having a culture of hate, and then also like thinking about fantasizing about starting race wars and all kinds of things can easily inspire people to step up these kinds of attacks.
So
So
Trump's own FBI director had to admit at a hearing, in a congressional hearing recently, that the majority of the shootings and incidents of domestic terror that his agency has investigated involve people espousing something like white supremacy. You could sort of tell that he was reluctant to come out and admit that. But that just happens to be the case, and he's sort of forced to rely on facts rather than rhetoric. In his speech about the Gilroy shootings, Trump did not, of course, say anything about the shooter's alleged white supremacist views. Instead, he talked about evil and stopping evil and preventing violence and protecting the safety of all Americans, and of course, thanking law enforcement, who, quote, never let us down. And indeed, of course, police killed the shooter in just in a minute or so. So Trump wants to criminalize Antifa. Just a couple of days before the Gilroy shooting, he posted a tweet saying, "We're considering declaring Antifa as a terrorist, as an organization of terror." Melissa, what is Antifa? Is it even an organization?
Well, I mean, if we're talking about, organizations that spread terror and commit acts of terror, as even if we're going to consider Antifa an organization, it's a pretty terrible terrorist organization in that it hasn't actually killed anybody. As opposed, on the other hand, 50 out of the last 50 extremist related murders have been at the hands of white supremacists. So I would say, at least, taking the score, Antifa is a pretty terrible terrorist organization if it is actually one. But that kind of speaks to the point, right? Antifa is not an organization. I mean, there are groups of people that, when they see, violent injustice on the streets, decide that, that's not something that they can tolerate, and they, step up to confront it. I think, I mean, Antifa, again, is short for anti-fascist, right? So, if anti-fascism is criminalized in society, who are the only people who are going to benefit from this, right? You have to think of what's the other side of the anti, right? So I think that's a very dangerous step, because especially because, what is the sort of enforcement that's going to be thrown behind it? There are no member roles for Antifa. There are no, there's no membership card, right? So what that does is it sort of opens the door for anybody, right, to who resists the injustices that are mounting at this time. Anybody who protests the concentration camps for migrant children, or, tries to stop, a random violence on the street against black and brown people, any of that can be classified as anti-fascist activity, because it is. It is resistance to, right, terror and injustice and a authoritarian society. And so, what he's criminalizing really is any resistance to his authoritarianism, which is, again, an extremely, extremely dangerous a position to take.
Now, just a few weeks before he made this provocative announcement, the conservative journalist Andrew Ngo from Portland, Oregon, said that he was beaten up by Antifa, doused with a milkshake and beaten in an unprovoked assault. Pictures of his injured face have made the rounds of media. Do you think that gave some impetus? And it's not really clear what exactly happened and who was responsible, whether they call themselves Antifa or not. But did that sort of, it's possible that Fox News covered this and Trump was watching it and decided to make, you know, his declaration about Antifa being considered to be a terrorist organization.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. The sort of, you know, provocateur activity of a lot of like right wing pundits, is very well known. I mean, you have, again, And this also has to do with kind of the dynamics of the media, right? The media, what is the phrase? The blood sells headlines or something like that. And, you know, I've seen it myself at demonstrations where, you know, some right wing person will like walk around for literally hours shouting, you know, racist things, obscenities, and just trying to get somebody to just punch him in the face. The minute he gets punched in the face, he runs to a camera and starts talking about the thuggish behavior of people when, you know, again, what the camera didn't capture is the, you know, the provocative behavior and the restraint actually of the crowd before somebody finally was fed up, right? You know, this is also has to do with, again, you know, the victimization narrative sort of playing out in the defense of the powerful, you know, I mean, you know.
So it's like Trump accusing Elijah Cummings of being a racist.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, and that's, you know, that's rule number one in the playbook that Goebbels actually invented, which is, you know, always accuse your opponent of that which you are guilty.
There was a lot of activity from Germans on Twitter in response to Trump's claim that Antifa would be considered to be an organization of terror, who were extremely upset, saying, you know, my grandfather fought against fascists and, you know, would have been considered Antifa. That lack of historical education about fighting fascism seems to, and that ignorance really seems to feed into, unfortunately, mainstream narratives of radical left-wing violence being equal to, you know, being this phrase to describe Antifa.
Absolutely. And this is absolutely not new. You know, I just saw on social media recently a reprint of a newspaper from 1933 in which Hitler demonized, you know, the Communist Party as being violent thugs and almost the exact same rhetoric. I mean, I'm not saying history is repeating, but it is certainly rhyming. And, you know, and if anybody would know sort of what the consequences of that are, it is, of course, the German people. It is also kind of curious,
and
however,
the
that
people, of course, yes,
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, and you know, and all of the groups that were demonized and exterminated under the Nazi regime. It is, however, interesting to like notice actually the amnesia in American society, right? About, you know, that we. America, to be American was to be anti-fascist for a really long time, right? It was kind of like undisputed common knowledge for a long time that, like, you know, like from Indiana Jones to, you know, that Nazis were kind of like the quintessential villain and was kind of used to that effect in our culture for a very, very long time. You know, I don't know whether or not it's because the World War II generations are, you know, sort of finally kind of they're dying out, and so that knowledge and that that attitude isn't passed on. I don't know if it is because again, in the popular imagination and in a lot, especially of young people's lifetimes, right, we have been the imperialist aggressor, right, for most of that time. So you know, it is really disheartening, right, to see this kind of like ignorance, amnesia, and reversal in American society, that, like, you know, like it was kind of a matter of course that Nazis were bad. You know, why this is not obvious.
We could take
everyone.
That for granted once upon a time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Fascism and bad, anti-fascism good. That shouldn't be an issue.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Captain America, actually, the very origin of Captain America as a character is an anti-fascist, is an anti-fascist icon. Jack Kirby, who created Captain America, was Jew, a passionate Jewish anti-fascist who, participated in militant movements against the Nazis. And so, the it, and for so long, for at least, the memory of that generation, the essence of America itself was to be against fascism. I mean, like putting aside all the other stuff, I mean, at least we could agree that Nazis were bad, right? So,
So I'm wondering, Melissa, whether you think that Trump's declaration on Twitter about the Antifa, basically equating them with MS-13, who has also been a very good way for him to launch attacks on immigrants, whether that particular very, very provocative tweet was his standard attempt to stir up trouble, to stir up anger, to stir up people into a frenzy. On the one hand, it's hard to ignore him. On the other hand, one doesn't want to take the bait.
it's whether or not, I don't know if we have a choice whether or not to take the bait, in that the big fish that he's really fishing for are the people who are going to come for us. You know what I'm saying? What he's doing is, for whatever reason, whether or not it's, making racism the centerpiece of his 2020 re-election bid, which a lot of people have been speculating, or just to sort of polarize, a society to a point that, people are going to want a strong man to come in and like restore order. There's a lot of, motivations there that we can think of that benefit Trump personally as, as president. But, but what is clear is that the effect, the actual like consequence of his words and his actions and his attitudes is harming people. It is putting our communities at risk. It is, inspiring people who, may or may not have that sense of social restraint and empathy that the rest of us have to come and commit acts of violence like what happened in Gilroy, a few days ago. So whether or not we choose to ignore or to, fight back at his comments, kind of doesn't matter because the violence is coming to us. And so we have to figure out as communities what we need to do in order to sort of prevent this, I don't know, this virulent, these virulent people from coming over and, sowing discord and chaos in our own communities. I think this is a call for us, who, I mean, not necessarily to like, go and punch Nazis or whatever, but at least to like, figure out what we can do to protect each other, to defend each other, and especially to resist the narrative that gives into fear and hatred and violence.
I'm wondering, Melissa, if you think that one strategy or tactic can be that if Trump is going to declare Antifa an organization of terror, even though it's not an organization, that it makes sense for those of us who really stand up against fascism, regardless of what we think of the tactics of some people who call themselves Antifa, that we all declare ourselves Antifa. Fine, you want to, if you want to criminalize this idea, which is, of course, an attempt to frighten people and to force people to back off from confronting fascists, then maybe the most effective response is to declare oneself Antifa in mass numbers.
Absolutely. I think that's the only really the only way to really combat this. And again, Antifa is short for anti-fascist, right? If you are a decent human being, you are an anti-fascist. If you are, anyone other than privileged white people, who own property, right? You are an anti-fascist. If if you believe in your community and that all the children should be respected, that you are an anti-fascist. And so, yeah, I mean, I think the best defense against that, again, is to, you know, is to reclaim, is to claim that mantle for everybody who's on the side of decency and justice, and, you know, just a life that doesn't, you know, that doesn't include genocide. I mean, it's so crazy because it seems so common sense. And yet, you know, that is part of, you know, Trump's, you know, a media plan. It goes all, again, going all the way back to Goebbels, is to confuse the public, to destabilize society, so that, you know, out of that chaos, the authoritarian strongman can come and restore order. What we need to do is break that pattern by saying, no, you know, we are the people. This is supposed to be a democracy. And so, you know, we are not going to allow, right, that chaos from consuming our communities. We are going to be the ones who will, you know, restore a democratic order amongst ourselves.
Are you surprised or not that, as far as I can tell, nobody in the Democratic Party has responded to Trump's threat around Antifa in any way? I mean, it's just kind of fallen by the wayside. I mean, the only people who seem freaked out and upset about it are people on the left, you know, and people who are actually anti-fascist and who sort of declare proudly that they're anti-fascist?
Well, I mean, I guess I don't expect much from the Democratic Party nowadays. You know, I mean, in any kind of sort of polarizing moment, and this was exactly the same in 1930s Germany, it wasn't two sides, it was three. There was the far right and the fascist right. There was a far left, right? The sort of left wing of the Social Democrats and the communists and sort of the smaller radical parties that opposed it. And then there was the mainstream, who were the Social Democrats, who, this is true of the mainstream Democrats as well, is kind of like living in denial that the world has changed, right? Like trying to hold on to a status quo that just doesn't exist anymore. And so, you know, one of the lessons from that, actually one of the lessons from that experience, is that, you know, we cannot count on them to, you know, to mount any kind of effective counter narrative, because again, they're not even perceiving the game for, or the reality for what it is. And so I think that, but I do think that it's not just the far left, and it's not just the people who are, you know, militantly or, you know, self-declared anti-fascists who are, you know, alarmed and shocked at, you know, the way things are going. I've seen, you know, on my own Facebook feed, as well as, you know, sort of out there in society, people who, are just regular people who are kind of shocked and want to resist and, right, you know, do not want fascism to take over America. I think in that sense, what little remains of our national memory around World War II and of, you know, what it means to fight the Nazis as Americans, could hopefully work in our own favor, you know, that even, you know, military families or like people who wouldn't necessarily, you know, identify as leftists, could still be horrified enough that, you know, at Nazis, you know, coming to our country, that, you know, they would at least be anti-fascist in spirit, if not, you know, necessarily like, you know, waving a red and black flag.
Well, so, Melissa, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I always appreciate your analysis.
Thank you, Sonali.
My guest has been Melissa Figueroa, PhD candidate in geography at UC Berkeley. She's also a faculty owner at the Cooperative New School for Urban Studies and Environmental Justice. And she's a longtime political educator and organizer involved in a wide range of movements for social and environmental justice in California. She's also one of our correspondents. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. You can also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali.